we take a look at the Environmental Protection Agency with a guest who saw the agency from the inside. For 25 years, E.G. Vallionados worked in risk evaluation at the EPA, and in a new book, he makes the case that the agency is falling down on the job.
He says outside forces have turned the EPA from an environmental protection agency into a polluter protection agency, and it's having some serious effects, he says, on public safety and the environment.
E.G. Vallionados is the author of the book Poison Spring, The Secret History of Pollution and the EPA. E.G., welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Well, as we mentioned, you spent 25 years working for the Environmental Protection Agency. Why do you say that the agency has failed Americans?
Because I learned that the hard way, this is exactly what's going on. That is, slowly I began to not talk in interview and talk to my colleagues, but by reading the memos and briefings and other papers within the agency, it became obvious to me that the agency was not doing what it was supposed to do, which is to protect our health and the environment. And there are many cases. I focus primarily on pesticides because Rachel Carson had written that wonderful book in 1962, Silent Spring. And 50 years later, unfortunately, we are still in that path. That is, the farmers overuse extremely toxic chemicals that have not been really tested honestly to tell us exactly what they do to insects, to honeybees, to us. And yet we are hooked in this kind of system of spraying and spraying and spraying.
Now, at the heart of your argument and what you say you saw during those 25 years is the notion that the Environmental Protection Agency has been more or less taken over by the interests of the chemical companies themselves rather than existing to serve the American public and the environment. How did that happen? And can you describe a little bit what you think, what you saw?
Yes, I mean, it happened from the very beginning. With Rockefeller as the first administrator, down to today with Obama being the president. The industry exerts an inordinate influence, number one, through the White House, through Congress, and number three, directly. That is, industry lobbies talk to EPA staff almost daily. They fund hundreds of trips that this staff takes to universities, to farms, to other places. And there's that intimate connection. And then number equally important, we have the political appointees within the EPA. These are people that the president appoints, and they direct the major programs of the EPA. And they, after the president is through with his tenure, then these guys end up going and working for the so-called regulated industry. So the line of communication continues to exist, and they exert a very inordinate influence, usually to make it smooth for the chemicals that they support to get to the market. And another major consideration is that the way these chemicals are tested, in the 20th century at least, we EPA discovered plenty of laboratories that were actually making things up. There was a fraudulent tradition in testing. And it may well continue today, I don't know. But that problematic nature of the actual chemical, what it does to us and to the environment, continues to be a great uncertainty. And to me, if you're going to fix the system, you have to prohibit the chemical industry from testing its own chemicals. Those chemicals have to be tested by an independent organization that will be completely removed from the industry, and then they will provide honest reports to EPA so that EPA can make a valid decision.
Now, let's say that a chemical company wants to get a new chemical on the market, wants to get it approved and out there. What kind of process right now does it have to go through to prove that its chemical is safe?
Yes, they go to EPA and they begin to fill out the paperwork and they say we have this active ingredient and we promise that it's going to kill X insect, which is causing trouble to farmers in wheat, for instance. And then EPA says, fine, you give us a three-month study and see what effects does have on species that is biologically important insects like honeybees, and then what other things you discover. Meanwhile, they allow the chemical industry immediately to register, that is, they approve the use of these chemicals with a very tiny amount of data. Meanwhile, then they ask the chemical industry, the company, to do a two-year study. And then, but meanwhile, the chemical continues to be sold to the farmers. And then the 2 years become 4 years and 6 years. So this is the kind of very, very kind of unstable process, which is pro-industry process to allow very toxic chemicals to come into the market.
So if a company wants to get that chemical out there, they first have to do a three-month study proving the safeness and then a two-year study. Who does the study?
This is the problem. The problem is that they do the study. Either they do the study or they pay a laboratory to do the study. And EPA does not do any studies. The EPA only looks at paper, thousands of pages of paper. And occasionally in the 20th century, when I was there, we had the data audit people that used to go with people from the Federal Drug Administration. They would audit the laboratories. Now, all that audit system has been weakened to the point probably is non-existent. So they trust that the industry is honest. But I already suggested because of actually discovering fraudulent laboratories, there's a tremendous question mark about the validity or the genuine science that these people do in order to prove that their chemical does whatever they say it does.
Now, you say some of these companies use their own laboratories or some of them hire a private laboratory.
Yes.
Are these private laboratories labs that have been proved impartial and have no connection to the industry itself?
They don't. They may or may not have, but that's not important. What important is that they actually do the study outside of the government. So the government does not know what goes into the laboratory. And for instance, in the major fraud that EPA discovered in the 60s, the so-called industrial biotest laboratory outside of Chicago, they discovered that this chemical, these people that were testing the chemicals, if they discovered that an animal was developing cancer, they would simply replace the animal with a new animal. This kind of a fraud. They would do a 24-month study for 10 months, and then they would make up the data for the rest of the time. So, and then on the basis of that fraudulent report, EPA would approve. Indeed, the largest selling chemicals to this very day have been in market because of this tradition of fraud. And EPA never got rid of them, despite the fact that they discovered the laboratory that was doing the fraudulent study. And when people ask them, why don't you remove the chemical? Well, they said that this was the largest component of the chemical industry. They didn't want to put most of the chemical industry out of business. And at the same time, they said, we have complementary studies. And then they asked the companies to repeat their studies. Meanwhile, however, you and I kept eating or drinking milk that might have been contaminated with that chemical. That is the problem that we have to solve by not allowing these companies to actually do their own studies. We have to have an independent facility to do the testing so that we put our faith that, in fact, if they say it does not harm the environment, it does not harm the environment.
Now, you mentioned lab animals may be getting cancer. The company may replace that animal with another animal that doesn't have cancer and just proceed. And to talk about cancer, you suggest that, you know, when we go to fight for a cure for cancer, that this is sort of a ridiculous wild goose hunt because really it's the chemicals that are causing the cancer. What sort of evidence do you have that that's true, that it is the chemicals that are causing the cancer epidemic, if you want to call it that?
Because there's a scientific studies outside of the chemical industry that has shown many of these chemicals, like, for instance, DDT and the neonicotinoids they use now to protect their crops. Actually, they are carcinogenic, they are teratogenic, some of them are neurotoxins, like the ones that they use now that are killing, wiping out the honeybees. Neonicotinoids are terribly neurotoxin chemicals. And they started with a tradition. I remember in 1974 when EPA registered a neurotoxin known as parathion into nylon microcapsules, about 40 microns diameter, the size that is of a pollen, so that the honeybee would not know what it was picking up, pollen or poison. And the honeybee would return back to its hive, and all the hive would be dead. And I remember my colleagues, the ecologists, were protesting, and I have read, of course, their memos. They were telling their bosses don't, or at least put a moratorium to discover more about these chemicals. But no, they extended the usage not just in corn, but in soybeans, in alfalfa, and so on, in other crops. And that tradition fundamentally continues. That is, the industry is number one in the EPA priorities because of the political influence that the White House, the congressional people, plus the industry itself is having.
Now, there has been a pretty big outcry from beekeepers, conservationists, about neonicotinoids that people suspect are decimating the honeybee population. What happens when those people confront the EPA? Sometimes there have been lawsuits and say, you know, we need to ban these. What's going on there?
Yeah, what's going on there? The EPA says, well, we don't have any evidence that, in fact, it wipes out the honeybees. They used to sell that to my colleagues in the 70s and the 80s, and they continue to play the same music. I mean, the evidence is there. I mean, my colleagues would have brought in even pictures of piles and piles of dead honeybees, and that would made no difference, apparently. And the honeybee, the keepers, the beekeeper keepers are very weak. They write letters, they complain, they say, you decimate my honeybees, but no effect.
And did your colleagues speak out and say, we have some reservations, some concerns about these chemicals? And
yes, of course. They did what bureaucrats do. They write memos. They wrote memos to their superiors, citing the evidence, and they gave me copies of all these memos, so that's why I speak the way that I do. And the supervisors simply never bothered to respond to those memos. They simply said, we're going to extend the use of these chemicals to this crop or to other crop, to the other crop. That's why we have reached this tragic moment in our history where extremely valuable insect like honeybee is on the verge of extinction. I mean, they forget that the honeybee pollinates 90 crops in this country, and the crops alone are valued around $40 to $20 billion per year. And yet they care less. I mean, this is, regrettably, that's the politics of greed is overtaking Washington, D.C., and therefore it's overtaking EPA. I mean, EPA is not in isolation. It's part of the larger system of the government. It's part of the economic system, of the crisis we face right now as a society, of the divorce of people from nature. They don't know where their food comes from. Indeed, each time I teach at a college, and I was teaching last year, my students' key question is, where our food is coming from?
And we're talking right now with E.G. Vallianatos, who spent 25 years working for the EPA, and he's now speaking out about what he saw there and says the agency is failing Americans and catering to polluters. You can join the conversation with your questions and your comments at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. We're talking with author and former EPA employee E.G. Vallianatos. He says the agency has betrayed its mission of protecting Americans, and it's having a devastating effect on public health and the environment.
You can join the conversation. Do you worry about the role the EPA plays in regulating, especially chemicals, pesticides, that sort of thing? Do you have questions about what it was like on the inside working at the Environmental Protection Agency? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org.
And E.G., I apologize for jumping in on you before we went to the news there. Do you want to finish your thought? You were talking about how your students are wondering where their food comes from.
The problems we face, I mean, they are existential. I mean, I think the environmental crisis is really an existential crisis. Not just global warming, but the kind of questions that we are talking about, that is what we eat, the water we drink, whether they are clean, whether they are polluted, contaminated, and why they have been contaminated for all these decades. Rachel Carson did a fantastic job in 1962, and now we are 2014. Why should we actually be talking about the same thing? And this is the problem of agriculture. Agribusiness is too large. It has devastated, it has emptied the countryside of America. Now you go to the Central Valley and you don't see people. You only see huge, straight expanses of land and no communities. So this process of supporting giant agriculture has been inimical to democracy, and it has been inimical to our own public, to our own health and the environment. So we need to change all that. And EPA is simply one of the major reasons why we are in the predicament we are. And I don't blame EPA directly. I blame the people who influenced the agency to be what it is today.
Well, I want to ask you about that. When you saw things going wrong in the agency, when you saw the chemical companies seemed to be having undue influence and chemicals were getting approved that you and your colleagues thought were unsafe, why did you stay? Why didn't you get out and start beating the drum that something was rotten?
I did.
You were there for 25 years.
I did it in my own small way. I mean, I was talking to congressional staff privately, of course. I was talking to people who listened. And I was talking to my own colleagues. And, of course, I was writing my memos. And I sent my memos up. And, you know, the people who run the agency told me that you are not a team player. Mm. And if they tell you you are not a team player, you are completely out. They isolate you. They stop promoting you. I mean, in other words, you pay a price. I mean, I couldn't do more than what I did. They would actually fire me. They did try to fire me once, but they couldn't. So it's you cannot really do very much because the so-called whistleblowers do not have the protection they actually deserve.
Let's go to the phones now. We've got some folks waiting to talk to you. We'll go first to Patrick in Brookfield. Hi, Patrick.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Yes.
I have both positive and negative experiences with the EPA, and I feel very sympathetic and with the resistance that this gentleman has had trying to do what the evidence tells him he should be doing and the politics involved. I remember one time there was a rule against polychlorinated biphenyls, PCBs, and they called it the fire rule. And one of the reasons is because when it would decompose, it would create phosgene gas, mm-hmm. and that further tightened the rules for PCBs. However, the phosgene gas came from a component of a mixture with PCBs, and I asked the EPA, why did they not regulate that chemical and just tighten the rules on PCB-filled transformers? The answer was Congress had banned PCBs and had not banned this other chlorinated hydrocarbon, therefore... they appreciate our efforts to spread the word, but their hands are pretty much tied. So I feel sorry for them in that regard. However, sometimes the EPA goes overboard, like navigable water systems for oil rules, oil spill rules, and they consider prairie potholes under that definition.
And okay, so, well, thank you, Patrick. I think we've got the gist there. And EG, do you want to respond to those different perspectives?
Yeah, I mean, the 1976 EPA did, in fact, I mean, Congress did, in fact, ban PCBs. And PCBs are extremely toxic. They last for decades in the environment. They have known about the toxic nature of these chemicals for decades. And we still find this stuff, and they're still burning them, and they still get them out of the rivers and so on. So I understand, I mean, the... Sometimes EPA can do so much. I mean, I blame EPA, but at the same time, I also see the bigger context within which the agency works. I mean,
I want to ask you about an aspect of your book that is relevant to Wisconsin. You write, there was a 2004 EPA study of gas fracking, which involves hazardous chemicals forced underground at high pressure, and concluded that it posed little or no threat. Now, this is the actual fracking, it sounds like, not the frack sand mining, but that these chemicals at the time were found not to justify additional study. And you note that an official inside the EPA said that 5 of 7 members of the study panel had conflicts of interest.
Could you
tell us about that?
Yeah, this came to me through a colleague of mine who retired from EPA, and he spent all his life, 30 years or so, working from the Denver office of the EPA. And he told me on the phone, and of course on the memo he wrote, He said that this is completely inappropriate. And of course, in 2005, when the Bush administration was in power, the Vice President Cheney, he collected all the representatives of the petrochemical industry, and they wrote a kind of energy policy in which they excluded EPA from having any impact or any control or any regulation on the water potential contamination because of fracking.
I'm just going to jump in here. So you said your colleague said it was completely inappropriate, meaning what? That the chemicals used in fracking could pose a risk to the drinking water?
It was inappropriate because they the people who made that consideration, they had conflicts of interest. So they should not have been part of the decision-making process. Mm.
Okay, thank you. Let's go back to the callers now. David joins us in San Francisco. Hi, David.
Yes, hi. I'm sure appreciate the guest's courage. Obviously, when you start opposing the biggest of the, as far as I'm concerned, they're welfare cheats. These are polluters. And when you start looking at medical care, if cancer is being caused by pollution, but these polluters are not paying our medical bills, now we see the entire country is torn up about the high cost of medical bills. And this is totally caused by the polluters. So obviously your guest is he's not tilting at windmills, but he's certainly opposing some of the biggest of the welfare cheats. You know, I wanted to ask him specifically about whether or not these chemicals in law, whether these chemicals are now being considered innocent until proven guilty. And, you know, this is very significant in that... As a human, I would love to have my civil rights protected in that way, but if lead is known to be a carcinogen or causing brain injury or something
gotcha,
like that.
Gotcha, David. So you're saying that that maybe for chemicals they should be guilty and until proven innocent, the other way around. What do you think of that, E.G.?
Yeah, most of the chemicals today, we have around 80,000 chemicals in the United States. In other words, the whole population of the country is more or less bathed in chemicals. Unfortunately, most of those chemicals have never been tested for either human or ecological effects. Now, the chemicals we're talking about, pesticides, for instance, there is a law that says you have to prove that the chemical that you want to register or the government approve it, it does not cause, quotation, unreasonable adverse effects on man and the environment, end of quote. But to prove that, I already hinted that the process is contaminated. I mean, it's there's a lot of fraud in that process. So, however, the other chemicals which are already in trade and they have not been tested, yes, the guess was correct. You almost have to prove. That is, EPA has to prove the chemical is causing a lot of damage before you actually remove it from the trade.
And E.G., we've got about 30 seconds left here, but now that you've written this book and you've sort of sounded the alarm, what would you like people and politicians to do about the EPA?
Politicians especially have to redesign EPA to be completely isolated from the political influences that are so deleterious to its existence. That is, we have to redesign and rewrite the law. For instance, the president can nominate an administrator for 10 years, for instance, but then the administrator would be able to appoint his own deputies, not the president. So make it like a Federal Reserve kind of institution. And then prohibit by law any kind of lobbying by industry, by the White House and Congress. If you do that, then that agency will be able to begin to protect us from this deleterious stuff that is all over us.
E.G., thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to E.G. Vellianos, the author of Poison Spring, The Secret History of Pollution and the EPA. He spent 25 years working for the agency.